nervous.
Let's try one more time. Mm-hmm. I want you to sign me up for Christian Jubilee. Write my name, write my name. Put it on the road. I've been changed since the Lord has lifted me. I want to be ready when Jesus comes. For the Christian Jubilee, write my name, write my name, put it on the road. I've been changed since the Lord has lifted me. I want to be ready when Jesus comes. Don't you want to go to that land? Don't you want to go to that land? Don't you want to go to that land where I found? Oh, don't you want to go to that land? Don't you want to go to that land? Hey, don't you want to go to that land where I found? Oh, won't you sign me up.
Spending this time in this important conversation. A couple of things that I've said all along, and I want to say it again today. I'm not asking for agreement. I look back over the course of my life, and there's things that I used to think that I don't think anymore. I don't know how many of you have run into your old self and you don't agree with yourself, right? And so the idea that somehow love and support hinges on agreement, that's really a silly notion. And it's a really worldly notion. Unity has to be something way more mature than that kind of thing. And so I'm not asking you to agree, but I will say this again. If you disagree, don't be lazy. Do your homework. Think through it. Well-informed disagreement that's done right is a discussion. Right? A really good, helpful discussion. I don't know how many of you have seen or read Chimamanda Adichie. She has one of the top TED Talks in history. So if you want to see one that will just light you up, watch Chimamanda Adichie. But she came from Nigeria, came to school in the United States. She's incredibly bright. And so she was getting ready to settle into school, and she meets her roommate. Now, they hadn't met, but her roommate knew she was coming from Nigeria. So Chimamanda gets there, she introduces herself to her roommate, and so she says hello to her, and her roommate says, oh, she said, I was surprised, you speak English. And she's like, well, yeah, English is the national language of Nigeria. And she's like, well, can you speak in your native language? Well, I am speaking in my native language. Right now. No, I mean your tribal language. This is my tribal language. So the roommate is clearly very disappointed. And so she said, well, can you at least share what's some of your favorite tribal music? And she said, Mariah Carey. But the power of Chimamanda's testimony is this, and you need to watch it because it's so worth it. She says, just be wary of a single story. There is danger in a single story. One of the reasons I love coming to Pepperdine is I grew up on the left coast. And if you're from here and you've lived elsewhere, you know why I didn't say west coast. Because people live under this assumption that if you grew up on the west coast, then that means you're left thinking. Well, maybe you are, maybe you aren't. And if you are, dynamite. And if you're not, fine. But that's a single story. You know, you go to New York City, and it's like, everybody out there is rude. I can't wait to get back to Atlanta. And then we get into Atlanta traffic, and someone runs someone off the road in a road rage. But we're good at that, because there are people. You see, a story is a way of classifying people in order to generate a story where you come out well, and to also generate a story where you can position others where you want them. And so one of the things you've got to be just thoughtful about is the danger of a single story. So Jesus said, well, how about this? What if we start off every story the way that the story of God starts? We love because he first loved us. Why don't we start with that? And so then he tells us, as we look at this, we come into this love first creed. We shared this yesterday, so I don't want to spend any more time working back through this, because you can look at this yesterday. But what I am pleading for is, and I'll say it again, in the Apostles' Creed, there's nothing in that creed that isn't either done by Jesus, said by Jesus, or done to Jesus. That's not the problem. The problem is that what Jesus said comes first is not even mentioned in any of the ancient creeds, the great creeds. So the Apostles' Creed, either version of the Nicene Creed, or the Athanasius Creed, the three major creeds that set the trajectory for the theology that you believe. Who is God, the Father, Almighty, Creator of heaven and earth? And who is Jesus? And who is the Spirit? And what about eternal life? What about resurrection? What about salvation? See, my issue has nothing to do with what's in the creed. It's what's not in the creed, because this is what Jesus said. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and the greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Today I want to take a few moments and tell you a story. If you have small children or grandchildren, you may have seen this blockbuster movie. It's the classic. Now, one of the reasons it's a classic is because it cost $60 million to film, and it brought in $469 million. So in the film industry, that's an instant classic. But they actually received just award after award after award, which is always kind of amazing when you think that they actually made the movie with Lego blocks. But how many of you know the storyline behind the movie? All right, I'll help you out. So these are the main characters. And by the way, you know, Morgan Freeman, Liam Neeson, Ivan Neeson, I mean, they're great all-star cast. So up there on the left side, you've got Evil Ward Business. He's the bad guy. Over here in the middle, you have Emmett Murkowski. Think Neo, and you got the guy. All right, if we're talking about The Matrix, this is Neo from The Matrix. And then you've got Wildstyle, who turns out to be quite the spiritual character. But you've got this guy over here. Who is Moses? This is actually not Moses. This is Vitruvius. And Vitruvius plays the role of kind of the prophetic voice in the movie. And what's happening in this movie is Evil Lord Business wants a perfect world. Who wouldn't want a perfect world? So his idea is, we'll build a perfect world and we'll glue it together. And once we get it glued together, then everyone will be right where I want them, doing what I want them to do forever. Not everyone's on board with that. There's a whole bunch of people that don't think that he should be the one who sticks people in their forever slot. So Vitruvius prophesies that one will come. And it turned out to be Emmett Murkowski from Brickburg. He steps up to the plate, and with a piece of special resistance, he goes to work, but it's a hard job. At his side is Wildside and Vitruvius. Well, if you're thinking I know that name, Vitruvius, here's Vitruvian Man. Now, how many of you remember Art 101 from college? It wrecked your GPA and you know it. You had an art guy who thought you should know this, or you'll be stocking shelves at Ralph's, right? And so, right? This is Leonardo da Vinci's version of this in 1490. This is based on inscription dimensions in Vitruvius in Book 3 of the Architecture. If you know about this, Vitruvius wrote these 10-volume series on architecture. He actually served Julius Caesar. He devoted this to Augustus. This is the only book of architecture from the ancient world, and it was published until the 20th century. Pretty good business if you died 2,000 years ago and you're a star of a movie and your book is still being published. This is him. It's a lithograph presented into Augustus. He's the guy who wrote these words that architecture had to be strong, usable, and beautiful. He's the one that elevated Corinthian columns, the one on the right, to the order. You guys remember this, right? Doric, Ionic, and you missed that one on your test. But he's the one that said that architects have orders or uniform conditions. What that meant was, is that every single time you build a building, you have to build it so that it's strong, useful, and beautiful. And you have to make sure you build it correctly. So if someone has already demonstrated what it takes to have a load-bearing column, that's the one you use every time. And he codified it in a book. Now, in Epidaurus, Greece, and I was looking for my wife, was that 2006 when we were there, is that right? Okay, so we went to this place, this is a model of it, and a famous temple of Asclepius, the healing god. You notice there in the middle is this tholos. A super famous tholos in our country is the dome of the Capitol building. Okay? The tholos, a circular building in the middle, this is a sacred building. This is where you meet with the gods. Here in Epidaurus, there's the tholos in the middle. This is the one that they're rebuilding, the model of it right now. But this is what it looked like when they found it. When archaeologists found this at the late 19th century and excavated it through the early 20th century, in the middle of that tholos, this is what they found. A lone Corinthian capital down in the sacred space of the tholos. No other thing down there, no column, no base, just this. So archaeologists begin to ask themselves, what in the world is this? And then they begin to realize it is the model left behind by the master builder so that every other Corinthian column in Epidaurus will be made according to these specifications. And they set it in a sacred space. So that for generations, when people build, they build according to the order, the specifications, the conditions set by the master builder. 1 Corinthians 3, this might become more familiar. For we are co-workers in God's service. You're God's field, God's building. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as a what? A wise master builder, right? Watch this. Those of you that know the background here, it's pretty easy to figure out. Sophos architectum, this is a wise master builder. Those of you that know the ancient language know that Jesus was called a tectone in the original language. He's a builder. We call him a carpenter, right? But notice this has arche on the front of it, which means master. So Paul says, as a master architect, God sent me into Corinth to lay a perfect foundation from which this church would build. And what is that foundation? So at the sacred center of every Christian's life, at the sacred center of every Christian home, in the sacred belly of the church, what will you find? Will you find Christ? The model around which every successive generation builds. Right? Well, maybe unless you're Corinth. Look at what it says. If anyone builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or stubble, straw, their work will be shown for what it is because the day will bring it into the light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each person's work. If what's been built survives, The builder will receive a reward. Here's another interesting thing. This word for builder is not the same one we saw earlier. This isn't architect. This is someone building on the architect's plans. So every builder, that's you and me, we will receive a reward. If it's burned up, we'll be saved, even though it's one escaping through the flames. So don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in your midst? If anyone destroys God's temple, how will they destroy God's temple? The only way you destroy it, according to this text, is you don't build according to the conditions left by the architect. So think about it. What was Vitruvius arguing for? If you're building a certain size building, right? Aqueduct. You can follow what I'm saying. Temple, library, whatever it is. What do you got to do at the base? Well, it's got to be strong enough to do what? Hold the next layer, which has to be strong enough to do what? Hold the next layer. What do you got to do under the ground? You got to make sure it's solid enough to do what? To hold up what's above ground. Everybody got it? So why were he so insistent on making sure you follow the conditions? Because they work, they save lives, and they make it what? Strong, useful, and beautiful. Well, this makes me wonder. I'm going to share something with you. And again, I'm going to just add. I'm not asking for agreement. I'm asking for consideration. And the second thing I want to clarify is I'm not even asking for a change of vocabulary. I'm advocating for a revolution. I hear people say all the time, they talk about God's unconditional love. Well, here's what happened. Back in 2013, I started a Bible study. I started in Genesis 1, and I went to Revelation 22, looking for God's unconditional love. What I discovered, some of you are nodding your heads, so you've done this Bible study, it's not in there. It is not in there. You could call God's love unlimited. You could call it eternal. You could call it infinite. But you actually do God's love a disservice calling it unconditional. Because look behind me. These are the conditions. Like the Corinthian column in the holy place of Epidaurus that said, no matter how long this city stands, if you're going to build here and you're going to put up a Corinthian column, it's got to look like this. Jesus says, whenever God encounters humanity, he never unhooks from his conditions. That's why you need his love. That's why you want his love. And that's why you depend on his love. Those of you that have struggled with a prodigal parent, prodigal spouse, or prodigal child, the reason you pray for them is because you're depending on the conditioned love of God. That he will be patient, and he will be kind. And he'll never give up. Even when he wants to give up, feels like giving up. When he confesses on the cross, my God, why have you walked out of me when I needed you most? But nevertheless, into your hands I commit my spirit. You see, I'm not asking you to change your vocabulary. Don't walk out of here saying, oh man, I like using the word unconditional love. No, don't. I'm not asking for changing vocabulary. What I'm asking is we change how we think about love. We'll say, well, I love my children unconditionally. Now, I know you don't. I know you don't. I got five of them. You do not. You love them the best you know how. And you know it. There's not a person in here who loves anyone unconditionally because you are not God. Well, you would if you had grandchildren. I do. And you don't love even your grandchildren unconditionally. You love them the best you know how. But here's what I would ask. What would happen in your relationships if you started devoting yourself to conditioned love? That your love would be patient. and kind. And that it wouldn't envy or boast or be proud or easily angered. What do you think of that? How many of you have loved someone the best you knew how, but you're still easily angered at them? Yeah. How many of you have loved hard, but then you've still been envious or jealous? How many of you acted rude? You see what I'm working on here? You feel where I'm coming from on this? What I'm suggesting is by talking about our love as if it's unconditional, I think we've unhooked from the conditions. I don't think we meant to. I just think it's what we did. So we end up doing things that are really fascinating. Like, Lord, evil. Illegal. One of the things we find ourselves doing is we really like people that fit where we put them. And if we could just glue them all to say the same thing and do the same thing, it'd be great. One of the things that's fascinating is that serving in the church this long is every single time someone tells me how awful a decision is that we're making, someone else has been waiting on that decision most of their life. And you know what's really fascinating? It's oftentimes people they love. Someone told me one time, "You don't understand, Don. I've never met a homosexual. I don't know any homosexuals." I said, "You do, because I've been at dinner at your home with a homosexual from our church. You just didn't know it because they know you're not a safe person to tell." Oh. Well, I think I could get on board with that Sally Geary lady and probably do better with homosexuals, but they'd have to kind of be quiet, and maybe if they could stay in the back, and it'd probably be better if we didn't even know. And so you want to glue someone in a place so that they're not really human. Well, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find that in God's dealings with his people. One of the fascinating things about the tabernacle that just flips me out. Leviticus is better than it gets. I mean, it gets terrible press, but it's better than people get. I love the description of the tabernacle in Leviticus 16 where it says that God made his dwelling among their uncleanness. He made his dwelling among their uncleanness. So the way God decided to love his people is to make his dwelling among their uncleanness. And you know that kind of fast forwards right to John 1:14, because some of your wheels are already turning, and you remember that when it says that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, that word dwelt is the same word for tabernacle back in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. So God comes again, and he dwells among uncleanness. John Mark Hicks challenged me this last year with the thought about what happened at the cross. He said, "You know how often we say that God turned away from the Son, Jesus, at the cross because of the phrase, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" He said, "You realize that you're bordering on moving from Trinitarian to binarian God. That somehow God stopped being Trinitarian in that moment. No, what actually happened is God took all of our sin and embraced it in Jesus, and through the blood of the sacrifice cleansed us in himself. God drew us in. This is what God does. So how do we love the people that are different from us?" So yesterday, the question was asked, Ross asked the question, "So what are some practical things we can do?" So one that many of you are familiar with, but I want to bring up that I think is really important. Stephen brought this up, but we actually did this the first time before Stephen came to North Atlanta. And that is, I shared this with you, some of you before, but this is our hospitality challenge. So this is where I think you can start. It's fun. It's doable. All your people can be involved in it. So this is where I ask you to start, the hospitality challenge. So in, I think it was 2014, if I remember right, in March, we challenged everyone in the church to have a meal in the home of another member. Now, how tough does that sound? How many of you remember growing up where like that was like common, right? And we wish it was more common. And here's the other thing. We said no restaurants allowed. I mean, unless you own it. Right? No restaurants allowed. What are we doing? We're getting in each other's face, right? We're going to actually go to each other's addresses, right? Oh, good grief. You would have thought I denied the virgin birth. It was such a comedy in our church. It was crazy. So here were the three main complaints. Okay, one of them was, I don't have time on my schedule. You're asking me to do one more thing, I don't have time on my schedule. Another one was, I don't have time to clean my house. Another one was, I just don't feel comfortable, you know, because like, you know, we live in an apartment, what will people think? Or, we live in a large house, I don't want to be judged. So this is how we addressed it. Got up in front of the church, and I said, okay, here's the three main complaints, and I just shared the same that I just shared with you. And I said, so let me make sure I understand the first one. There's 744 hours in the month of March. We've asked you to take two for a brother or sister in Christ. And your schedule is so cramped-packed that you can't find room for one meal for another Christian in a month? Well, you're sick. You're sick. Number two, if you cannot shovel a path from your front door to your dining room table in a month, you're sick. And number three, if we're going to let envy, jealousy, and covetousness make our hospitality decisions, we're sick. Instead of revolting, we repented. The month started off slow, ended wild. People in each other's home posted all over social media. People that didn't speak the language, getting somebody that was bilingual. Everyone going to the house together. It changed our church. We barely got to the end of the mark. We got to do it again, got to do it again, got to do it again. Why? Because what people realized was, when I get together with you and get to know you, it changes how I understand our stories. Right? But it also changes our vocabulary. Because now, I quit talking about the whites, the blacks, the browns, the Asians, the Latinos. I quit talking about them, and now I'm talking with them. It changes how we think. One of the funny stories from the movie The Blind Side, if you remember the story, family from Memphis, the mom makes this comment, who thought we'd have a black son before we met a Democrat? They put that in there for a reason, and you know that. Because what it establishes is, here's a family that are clearly God-fearing people, but they realized how sectioned off their life has become. Because they live by narratives, not by God's story. You feel what's happening here? Another very practical thing is the three words we begin to use over and over and over, and you'll hear it at our church all the time, is tell me more. So someone thinks, well, I think that president, the dumbest president, tell me more. Well, I just can't believe they tell me more. And what happens after about five tell me mores? They're like, well, I'm not even sure what I think. I got it. You know why? Because I'm so mad sometimes that I want to say things to feel better, not that I've thought better. Right? Agreed? It's kind of fascinating when we start leaning into other stories. I don't know how many of you have thought through this section of 1 Corinthians 13, right? The always protects, trusts, hopes, endures. Here's what I want you to notice. When you go back and you look at it, English or Greek, it doesn't matter. The word always is repeated four times. So that's the word Paul wants you to pick up on. He could have put some other words in there, but the word he's trying to get us to grab is the word always. So what I'm trying to say to you is, if you're reading this in the original language, it's not like the word always is in there once and then he lists four other qualities after it. He says always four times. So what's the key word? Well, you don't ever turn this off. So if you are God in heaven, you're perfect in love, you never turn it off. Never. Right. He's the same always. No shifting shadow. Think about that. Why do you tell someone that's been wayward from the Lord, all you need to do is just turn your heart to Him? Why do you tell them that? Because you know He'll be perfect in love. Right? God says, I'll tell you the conditions. Keep no record of wrongs. What did He say in Zephaniah? Oh man, you want to know what it looks like? I take your sins and throw them in the ocean. What did He say in Psalm 103? Man, as far as the east is from the west is how far I put your sins away from you. Right? What did He say in Hosea chapter 11? Oh, you guys ought to be in so much trouble you wouldn't know how to see straight. But I'm God and I'm not man. My heart's flipping over inside me like I'm convulsing. I just can't give up on you. Well, God can do whatever He wants. Except not with God. That's why He never I asked my dad one time, I said, man, you know, what does it take to be a disciple? He said, well, a lot. He said, here's the way I'd put it. Honor and honesty. Honor God with everything you've got. When you don't, be honest about it. Don't unhook from the conditions. But when you do, be honest about it. Right? I want you to think about this with me. Some of you remember Brian Delbeck, but you remember this crime? I was looking at our audience. This is why out of this end. I know some of you will need to Google this, and some of you remember this, right? But Medgar and Charlie Evers were terrific leaders in the voters' rights movement, and signing up voters' rights. Evers lived in Jackson, Mississippi. Delbeck was shot him, killed him. You see approximately 9 years in between Beckwith's frustration with Brown versus Board of Education and then killing Evers, shooting him right in front of his house. 1964, acquitted with an all-white, all-male jury, right? And he's let off. But in 1994, they got him back in court and they convicted him with the evidence that was so crystal clear and gave him life. How many of you kind of remember the highlights of that bumping along? Do you know how this happened? Some of you from Harding University that are represented here, you know how this happened, but I want to kind of tell you guys the rest of the story. So this is 1994. This is Evers' widow. Now you bear in mind, look at how long she's waited. 31 years with that case dead in the water, right? Well, what's fascinating is Boo Mitchell. Boo went to Harding for undergrad, Ohio State for grad, a journalist working with the Clarion Ledger. He sees a movie about this and is inspired to think to himself, what? There's got to be something that can be done. So he goes to work amassing the evidence, reaching out on cold trails, calling people on the phone, seriously, looking them up in the phone book and calling people on the phone that were involved in this. He and Gary said one of the fascinating things that they always answer the phone. Hey, what's up? You are in big trouble, pal. And Jerry just said about this, but listen, he didn't just said about this one. Crime after crime after crime, he kept cracking the codes, cracking the cases. Why? Because if you have the opportunity to use your life to bring love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control to the rest of the world, that's what love does. Jerry didn't have to quit being a journalist. All he had to do was not unhook from the conditions of love. So here's what I want us to think through. If you look at your vocabulary, what are some words, some slurs, some jokes, and some slangs that you use that actually emerged from a negative single story about people that have black skin, brown skin, white skin? What are some stereotypes? What are some words you use, some descriptors that you use that emerged from a negative view of people of different colors? Now, what if we said this? Lord, I've been following you a long time. It's tough to change habits. So here's what I need you to do. I've heard what we've been talking about all week. And I'm on board up here, but I'm not on board down here. But the thing is, I still want to fit in. So, I'm going to keep telling my jokes. I'm going to keep using those words. I'm not actually going to work on this whole Christ-conditioned love thing. But I need your Holy Spirit to make it look like I am. I know you're not normally on board with these things, but can we make an exception? So when other people hear my racist jokes or my racist epithet, and then I say I'm not racist, would you just do it like Pentecost and make them believe it? You say, well, that's silly. No one would pray that. No, it actually might be good for you to pray that. Hear how silly it sounds. And then pray something else. Say, Lord, you've loved me in ways that I clearly actually couldn't ask you for face to face. To give me breath, strengthen my body so that I can sit against you with the strength you gave me, and then ask you to forgive me for that. But that's the story of our salvation. So Lord, what I really need you to do is reshape the way I think about others and talk about others and interact with others. How many of you can recognize that if we are willing to let the Spirit do this to us, it's kind of exciting to think about what could happen through us, right? So if Amy and Stephen, if you guys will join me up here, well, they're joining me, so one of our ministers in Atlanta, after this refugee thing, kind of took on an unfortunate life of his own. Every time he would go to the store or somewhere, he would find someone who was clearly not born here, or perhaps they were, and then he could navigate if he had made a mistake. But he would walk up to them and just say, I want you to know, my name's Ken, I'm really glad that you're here. And I just wanted to ask you, where are you from? You have this beautiful accent, and that beautiful accent originated somewhere other than here. So oftentimes they say, well, I'm from here, but here. And he said, let me tell you something. I'm so glad you're here. We're better because you're here. And person after person, tears, thank you. The guard goes down. The fear drops. Now, isn't that something that Jesus had a way of doing? If you walk with Jesus into Samaria, that's what you see, wouldn't you? He'd stumble over to that Samaritan woman, and you're wanting to get the groceries and get out. And Jesus sits down and says, well, let's have a big old conversation with the Samaritan woman. We'll just stay around long enough to the disciples sweat and then figure out what to do next. Could we do something like that? Okay, so what I want to do, the two of you have experience in this, tell us a little bit. But one of the things I should have told you about is about you having lunch with a homeless lady in Nashville. Yeah, so why don't you tell the stories about taking the flowers and that?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate work in Nashville, Tennessee at Lipscomb University. And at Lipscomb, I encountered a lot of professors and peers who had a real heart for reaching out to our homeless population in Nashville. And seeking to establish very human connections. It's not just about collecting canned goods. It's not just about, collecting blankets or coats. It's actually about getting to know people, people who help build up our community. And so there's a newspaper distribution called The Contributor. Maybe you've heard of it, but a lot of our homeless citizens in Nashville give out newspapers, sell newspapers. And this is one way that actually you can get to know a lot of your homeless neighbors in Nashville. And so there was this one lady, I oftentimes don't see a lot of homeless women out and about as much as I see homeless men. I started to wonder why that might be. So I started to kind of keep my eyes peeled for women, because I really wanted to get to know some women. And I saw this woman standing there one day on the side of the road and selling The Contributor, and so I stopped and thought, I've got an hour before class, I've got time, and so pulled over, and I will confess to you, I was nervous. I'd never really done anything like this, especially by myself, and especially on a whim. I decided, okay, I've seen some of my mentors and peers do this, I'm going to get to know somebody today, I'm going to make a new friend. So I walk over and introduce myself to her and buy a newspaper. Ask her how her day is going. We talk about the weather, and we talk about where she's from, and kind of shoot the breeze, and then I'm thinking, okay, well, good good start. Like, I don't want to come on too strong. Like, if you ever try to make friends in any setting, you don't want to come on too strong. So, like, okay. So I said, do you come over in this area often? And she said, no, I'm usually over by the grocery store. I was like, can I come find you another time? She's like, sure. I was like, can we hang out? Sure. So every now and then when I would go to the grocery store, I'd go find her. Hey, how's it going? And then one day I was thinking, I love flowers. I was going to get myself some flowers. I should get her some flowers. So I go and get some flowers, give her some flowers, and she said, nobody thinks to give me flowers. Like, they give me a lot of really, old canned goods and things like that, never flowers. I was like, well, they're great, aren't they? And they're like, I love flowers. So I give her flowers, and the next time I see her, I was like, can we have a meal? She's like, sure. So we go have a meal. And we became good friends that way. And I got less nervous every time we hung out. It was pretty simple, actually. I had not thought about it in a little bit until you asked me about it.
Well, and I've thought about it for years, because how many of you have been in parts of that journey? You know, like meeting people, then the food part, the blanket part, right? I just thought it was interesting, because I'm the dad. She's our only girl. She's the youngest. And when she tells me she's going to have lunch with homeless people, you know, I'll be honest with you, in my heart, I'm kind of like, right? Can any of you relate to those? Okay, thank you. I'm not alone, right? Okay, thank you. But how many of you think that probably closer is something Jesus, we would see him doing? You see where we're coming from on that? Okay, Stephen, as a worship leader, leading at our church, what are you doing to try to help our diverse church feel that sense of welcome, family, belonging?
It's contextual. A quick story. One of my good friends that I just met when I got to North Atlanta, his name is Myra Karsten. She's been there for a long, long, long time. I know a lot about North Atlanta because of Myra. She helps with the praise team, plays piano so that my praise team can get their parts. And so we at North Atlanta, working on adding a second service, and we got to talking about the different songs that we were going to have to use. And so she comes to my office every Tuesday so that we can go over the music. And I was playing some music in my, I think Hezekiah Walker in my office, just jamming. And she came in, she's like, oh, man.
And she'd be in her early 70s.
Right, yes. And she's white. That's okay. Anyway, so I'm in there and I'm just going, and she's like, "Wow, that's for the second service." I'm like, "Yeah," and there's more to that, but just this. I go. I listen to this all the time. I said, and I'm working on an arrangement for first service for acapella. So we have an instrumental service and acapella. So I'm working on for acapella service. You're gonna be able to do that? I'm like, yeah. Why would we? Why would you? I was like, Myra. Is the blackness of the song throwing you off guard? I said, it'll work. It'll work. And that one conversation has led, and now our families interact, everything. And so from that, still piggyback on what I was talking about the other days that you've been here, and that it's just going, it takes time and being with someone. But I could see she was kind of uneasy. I'm like, and yeah, it's funny that you said she's 70, because our relationship literally is like, she's like, wow. And I'm like, yeah, we good. And now when I say we good, she understands what I mean.
Oh, I wish you could see this beautiful match made in heaven.
Donna runs in my office, man. In fact, every time when she's there, they grab a hug and they run.
Yeah. Yeah, my musical skills will change in the restoration of all things. Before we end up, here's what I want to thank you for. I want to thank you for engaging and being here and being a part of what we're doing. You understand we have to do this. It's not an option. I told you the other day to mark your calendars for October 31st, 2017. That is the 500th anniversary of Luther nailing those 95 theses on a church door. Well, actually, nailing them. It cost them a lot. You know that, right? But we're the beneficiaries of that. And what I just asked you to think about is not a world where, you know, light-skinned and dark-skinned people figure out how to tolerate each other's existence. You do not need the Holy Spirit for that. But for people whose jobs earn them a higher salary and people whose jobs earn them a lower salary, that we can figure out how to even up toward each other. What God wants us to do is to discover Him in each other. That the union we have with Him, that would be the union we have with each other. And that it births a new humanity. And with this hope, many of you who have our sisters in here, we didn't talk about gender issues much this week, and you've endured more than I can express in this session, so thank you. Our brothers and sisters from the South and from the East, Global East and Global South, you've been here and listened while we talked about issues that didn't directly speak to the ones that you endured. So what I would hope is the ones we did talk about would lay a foundation for the ones we didn't. You feel where I'm coming from? And that we would honor what Jesus did at the cross in the birthing of the new humanity. Because you know, Satan thought he closed the door on the project. And boy, was he wrong. So thank you for joining us. God bless you.